By the first day of the first month of Noah's 601st year, the water had dried up from the earth. Noah then removed the covering from the ark and saw that the surface of the ground was dry. By the 27th day of the second month, the earth was completely dry. Then God said to Noah, "Come out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons and their wives. Bring out every kind of living creature that is with you, the birds, the animals, and all the creatures that move along the ground, so they can multiply on the earth and be fruitful and increase in number on it." So Noah came out, together with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives. All the animals and all the creatures that move along the ground and all the birds, everything that moves on land, came out of the ark, one kind after another. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease." Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth." So if you can get a hold of a Bible, it'd be good to do that and look at that Bible passage that Johnny just read. It's Genesis, end of Genesis chapter 8, page 10. That's where we're going to be. Easy to find. Quite a lot of people here I don't recognise today, so it's a fair bet that a lot of you don't recognise me. It's good to see you. As Johnny said, my name's Steve. I'm on the staff of Kensington, the church that Village is part of. Actually, I have the privilege and joy of sharing an office with Johnny. Got our names on the door now nicely, haven't we, Johnny? So that's nice. But last Tuesday, the streets around the Kensington Church building where Johnny and I are based seemed to be full of TV crews and cameras. What were they doing there? Well, as you've probably heard, news has spread across the country that a 15-year-old Somali girl had disappeared from her home, made her way across Europe to Turkey, and it is thought very possibly is going into Syria to join the IS fighters. How has this happened? How has she become radicalized through the internet, maybe? What will become of her? No one knows. But people are very anxious. What we do know is that her home where she lives is just behind our building in Easton. That's where she lives, that's where her family live, and that's why the cameras were there. We do know that. And we do know that her case has brought the impact of the Islamic State conflict right into the heart of our city. And we're all aware that we're living in a time of tremendous turmoil right throughout the world. A time that most of us would certainly say we have never seen before in our lifetime. We have never lived through a time like this. From the conflicts of South Sudan and the Central African Republic through the rumbling civil war in Ukraine, through to even the streets of Hong Kong in the last couple of weeks, from the terrorist outrages of Boko Haram in the north of Nigeria, and Al-Shabaab in Somalia, through to the horrors of IS in Iraq and Syria, not to mention a score of other trouble spots. The world is full of turbulence and suffering. We see it on the news every day, and we can't escape its impact. Of course, for many of us, it's the turmoil in our own little world that fills our thoughts. It's not someone else's kids, perhaps, that you're worried about. It's your own family. Not the conflict thousands of miles away, but the conflict in your own home or in your own heart and mind. Trouble, perhaps, that no one else ever even knows about or can see. The world out there is a sea of instability, and very often our own private lives seem just the same. The story of our lives seems to be the story of searching for fixed points, a quest for anchor points that will not move when everything else seems to be shifting. And so we look for stability through friendships, through relationships, in marriage, in the apparent stability of the homes we live in, or in the supposed security of money in the bank. In all this, we search for something or someone to rely on, somewhere we can rest. It's no accident the most popular sitcom of all time had a theme tune called I'll Be There For You. Because that's what we want, someone who will be there for us. Actually, what we'll be looking at tonight, what Johnny will be speaking on in the evening service, is precisely this subject of friendship, what it can do for us and what it can't do for us. We're looking for someone to rely on. We long for fixed points and faithful people. And here in the Bible, in this story that comes at one of the great turning points of human history, we actually find what we're looking for. Here, God presents himself as the one we can rely on, the one who is fixed and faithful and for us. What we have here is a snapshot of his character and his plans for the world that reveal what he is like and why we can trust him. Story that Johnny read comes at the end of the narrative of the Great Flood. But to get the setting, we ought to have a quick look at what happens before that. Shouldn't take long. We're only on page 10 of the Bible after all. So, in the beginning, God made the worlds, the heavens and the earth and everything in them. That's page 1. It was perfect. It was beautiful. And pretty soon, we screwed it up. Adam and Eve, our first parents, rebel against God. They decide they know best and they'd rather like to be gods themselves. That's what we call the fall. And that's not just a little local trouble. Adam and Eve's sin and rebellion sends shockwaves out throughout the world. The harmony and perfection God gave to the world is disturbed and dislocated and ruined. And running through the human heart ever since that day, there is a desperate streak of sin, like a destructive virus that infects everything we do. We see it in the first generations of Adam's descendants. Pretty soon there's the first murder. Cain gets jealous and kills his brother, Abel. And as the years and the centuries pass, far from improving, humanity only deteriorates. Evil proliferates in the earth. And in response, God eventually determines to send the great flood as a judgment on the earth to wipe out the race and make a new beginning. Just one man and his family, 8 people, are to be spared. Now, if you've seen the Russell Crowe film of recent months, Noah, you will have pictures in your head of what the flood looked like. And Hollywood, of course, took all kinds of liberties with the biblical account, which I'm not going to begin to go into this morning. We'll be here all day. But at least the film conveyed something of the horror and the scale of the cataclysm which carried the race to destruction. The flood is a colossal act of God's judgment. Preparing for this Sunday, I once more came across atheist objections to the story of the flood as some nice, gentle tale, the way that, frankly, we'd sometimes taught it in Sunday school. A quiet outing on the sea, a happy family and their menagerie of smiling chimps and grinning giraffes sticking their heads out of the top of this ark as they float cheerfully along. Well, people are right to object to that view of the flood. Frankly, this story is terrifying. It's dreadful. And for those few who pass through it and survive, it's a shattering experience. A time of upheaval and destruction lasting almost a year. And of course, the familiar patterns, the rhythm of the seasons, the growing of crops, all totally disrupted. And into this devastated world, Noah and company step out from the ark, searching and hoping for a new beginning, and desperately needing reassurance from the Lord. Behind them, as they step out, this great wooden structure, their home for the past year, grounded firmly on the mountainside and looking rather the worse for wear. Ahead of them, they don't know what. So we pick up the story at verse 18. of Genesis chapter 8. So Noah came out of the ark, together with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives. All the animals and all the creatures that move along the ground and all the birds, everything that moves on land, came out of the ark, one kind after another. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it, on the altar. Noah's very first action is to build an altar and make sacrifices on it. And as he does that, he's saying two things. He's giving thanks to God for their survival. They've been spared from destruction. They've survived all these months floating on the surface of the floodwaters. And then he's asking God for a relationship. That is what blood sacrifice was all about. It is a plea. It's an appeal to God that we can relate to him. Noah is crying out to God for mercy and love. And then we have the Lord's response in verse 21. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done." So God is pleased with Noah's sacrifice, and not because in some bizarre way he likes the smell of smoke. It's on a summer evening, he might sniff the air and say, "Oh, someone's having a barbecue, that's nice." How ridiculous that would be. No, he is pleased with the burning sacrifice because he sees what's in Noah's heart. And in his mercy, he makes this promise, never again, no more floods. And notice this, is not because the human race has suddenly come good. God's verdict on the state of our hearts is exactly the same after the flood as it was before. You can see that if you glance back to chapter 6, verse 5, before the flood, where similar words are used. The verdict afterwards is just the same. The flood didn't make us better. Every single one of us, God says, is naturally bent towards evil all the time. That's the Bible's consistent diagnosis of the human heart. But the Lord has resolved to make a new start with the family of Noah. And that's what he does. And in that setting, he makes this promise in verse 22, which we're focusing on this morning. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, will never cease. Now, look at the first line of that. As long as the earth endures. He doesn't promise that the world will last forever. In fact, this promise implies that it won't. But as long as it does, the Lord says, all these things will continue. These pairs of opposites, summer and winter, night and day, cold and heat, and seed time and harvest that we especially think about at this time of year. These things that define the rhythm of normal life, they're not going to stop ever again as long as earth endures. The world will keep on turning. The sun will keep shining. Plants will keep growing. Harvest time, there will be crops in the fields. That's the promise. Now, this is not a promise that the world will work perfectly. Remember, this promise is given in a world that's fallen. It is broken. It is sick. There will be times locally where crops fail. We will experience droughts and storms because we live in a world that was ruined in the first place by human sin. Not to mention the additional damage that we're doing now through our pollution and greed. So this world is never going to work perfectly. Nonetheless, God gives this promise, even in a world that is fallen. Never again a world-destroying cataclysm. Now, where does this leave us? What does all this tell us about God and why he is the one we can rely on? This story from thousands and thousands of years ago. We need to know what it means for us. So let's look at this more closely in two stages. First, regular laws point to a faithful God. Regular laws point to a faithful God. Let me ask you this. When you went to bed last night, did you worry about whether the sun would rise this morning? You worried about that, dropping off to sleep? Ah, oh, wonder Wonder if it's going to get light tomorrow. Wonder if the sun's going to come up. No, of course you didn't. You take the alternation of day and night for granted. We all do. And in that sense, at least, you believe God's promise here in verse 22 in the Bible. You believe it. The sun will rise each morning because the sun will still be shining and the earth will still be rotating. And why is that? The sun will still shine because the physical laws that govern the energy production in the sun will be exactly the same tomorrow as they are today, as they were yesterday. The nuclear, electromagnetic, and gravitational forces, all of which are needed to keep the sun firing in the constant and stable way that it does, will be exactly the same. And the earth will still be rotating because of a principle called the conservation of angular momentum, which basically means that things that are spinning keep spinning at the same rate unless some force acts to slow them down. And all of that, even if we haven't got a clue how any of it works, we absolutely take for granted. There is a constancy, a faithfulness built into the innermost workings of the universe. If you left carrots in your fridge this morning, there's a fair chance that you did, you can be pretty confident that they won't have turned into mushrooms by the time you get home, or cheese. If you have an apple tree in your garden, it's most unlikely that you are picking strawberries off it this autumn, because nature is constant. Why can a diary tell you when it's going to be full moon? How can we know exactly where a comet is going to be years in advance so that we can send a spacecraft to land on it at the exact point where it's going to be in several years' time and calculate the exact moment of the rendezvous? How can you be so sure that when your toddler knocks a bowl off a high chair or the table that it will always fall on the floor instead of hovering in midair? Always happens. All of this is the way God has made the universe to be. And you see, the regularity of nature, whether it's on the small scale or the grand scale, points us directly to the faithfulness of God. The laws of nature are the same here and in my house, in Eastville, and in Africa, and on Mars, and on Alpha Centauri. And they were the same 1,000 years ago, as they are today, and as they will be 1,000 years from now, if the earth still endures. And they are that way because our Creator God is that way. It's His world, His universe, and His laws. Regular laws point to a faithful God. We can rely on Him for this. Second, a faithful God makes a personal commitment. A faithful God makes a personal commitment. God's faithfulness is not just about keeping everything going in some impersonal manner, moving a comet around there, keeping the earth rotating impersonally. No, His faithfulness comes home to us. Look again at what He says to Noah here. Even in the light of extreme evil, the Lord holds back judgments. There will never be such a world-destroying flood again while the earth still stands. He reiterates that commitment in chapter 9, verse 11. I establish my covenant, that's a binding agreement, with you. Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And He's kept that promise. People often ask, if God is really out there, why does He not put a stop to all the evil in the world? Of course, plenty of people think that's because He isn't there. He's not there at all, so He can't do anything. Or if He is, He can't see the troubles on the earth. Or He's not strong enough to do anything about it. But the Bible tells us over and over and over again what it tells us here in verse 21. God is not unaware of the evil in the world, nor is He powerless. But in order to put a stop to all the evil in the world, He would have to put a stop to you and me. Because the problem in the world is not just some abstract problem that's out there. organizations like Boko Haram and Islamic State just spring out of the earth, fully formed, and need to be dealt with. The problem lies in my heart and in your hearts. You could take the evil in my heart and pretty much construct something as bad as IS just from what you find in there. And the same is true of you. Problem isn't out there somewhere. Problem is in here. And if God was to put a stop to all the evil in the world, he'd have to put a stop to you and me. And that's the truth. He'd have to sweep us all away. And he's promised to hold back from doing that. Never again, he says, as long as the earth endures. And God's words are not empty. God does not say, wouldn't it be a good idea if? No, what he says goes. It happens. It's his personal commitment. We can rely on him for this. So this story presents us with a God who is faithful in the world of nature and faithful personally to the human race. And in the light of that reassurance, Noah's family move out. They come out of the ark as the Lord tells them to, and they spread out and they multiply and they fill the world. But we said this was a snapshot of God's character. This is just one frame in the whole long story of God's dealings with the world. It doesn't actually resolve anything. It doesn't answer all the questions. Here are a couple of questions that are raised by this story. If humanity is as evil as God says here, why does he let us carry on at all? Why does he put up with us? That's a question we should ask when we read this story. And then, what is this about as long as the earth endures? What's that about? What happens when it doesn't endure? What happens afterwards? And the answers lie in what happens further on in the story, after page 10. In the centuries that follow, yes, the human race continues to behave just as badly as before. Wars, atrocities, evil empires that rise and fall. It's still happening. We're still like this today. But the rescue story of the ark points forward to a greater rescue. For Noah, the Lord provides a refuge from the flood in the shape of the ark. And thousands of years later, God provides a refuge in the shape of another wooden structure stuck on a hillside. The refuge God provides is the cross of Jesus Christ. The cross where Jesus was nailed up to die. This is God's rescue plan for humanity. And this second rescue plan is not temporary. It doesn't just endure for a year. It is permanent. It isn't confined to just 8 people. It will provide for millions. And the cost of providing this refuge is infinitely high, because it costs the agony and death of the Son of God. The great flood of God's judgment against sin fell on Jesus Christ and swept him away to death. The cross, Jesus in his love, paid the penalty for our sin and disobedience and rebellion. If we trust in him, the death of Jesus rescues us from the ultimate flood. Why does God put up with us when we're as sinful as we are? When we're as messed up and as outrageously evil as we actually are in God's sight? Why? Because there's a rescue in wood and nails. We can rely on him for this. And the cataclysm of the flood points forward to something else. The cross stands in our past now. It happens. But there's something else that still lies in our future. As long as the earth endures, it won't always. People assume that this world will just carry on indefinitely as it is now. But the Bible shows us that's not true. Jesus Christ, who came once to die on the cross, will come again. He will come back, this time as the judge of all the earth. And close to the other end of the Bible, we find the Apostle Peter writing about that day in these words. It's in 2 Peter chapter 3, from verse 3, beyond the screen. Above all, he says, you must understand that in the last days, scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, where is this coming he promised? That's the coming of Jesus Christ again. Ever since our ancestors died, everything's gone on since the beginning of creation. Nothing changes. But they deliberately forget that long ago, by God's words, the heavens came into being and the earth was formed out of water and by water. By these waters also, the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. By the same words, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly. But do not forget this one thing, dear friends. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. Instead, he is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by fire. And the earth and everything done in it will be laid bare. See what Peter is saying here. Look at what he says. Skeptics say that the world just carries on as it has done from the beginning. They say nothing will ever change. We'll just carry on. They certainly deny that Jesus will ever return. But wait a minute. This is what you have to remember. God made the world out of formless nothing at the beginning. And then he destroyed the world. You see how verse 6 makes this direct connection with Noah's flood. And just as the flood destroyed that world, so a greater and more comprehensive destruction is coming to our world at the end of time. And that day will come. On that day, this alternation of seed time and harvest and summer and winter and day and night will come to an end. There won't be any more. A day when the world as we know it will be no more. And Peter goes on to say how we should respond to this news from verse 11 of that same letter. Since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be? You ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. That day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat. But in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth where righteousness dwells. Just as there was a new beginning after the flood, as Noah and family stepped out of the boat, just as there was a new beginning there, so there will be a new start after the day of judgment. A much greater and much more radical new start. In fact, a whole new heavens and a new earth, a whole new world. And people who belong to Jesus Christ will live in that new earth. And we're looking forward to that day. Because when that happens, there'll be no more turbulence in the world as there is today. There will be no more evil. There will be no more pain and suffering and death. It will be finished. The world wasn't restored to perfection by the flood, but on that day it will be. It will be remade. It will be new. And it will be perfect. And so will we. Even more amazing. A perfected environment for perfected people. And we can rely on him for this. And what we want to do here this morning is very simple. We want to call you to trust in this trustworthy God. That's what we're here for. That's what you need to do. Noah and his family couldn't be rescued by the ark unless they got on board. The ark was there, all ready to float. The rain was falling. It was just about to float away. It wasn't going to do them one iota of good until they got on board. They needed to be inside. And for us today, the cross of Jesus Christ is there. It has happened. The rescue plan is in place. But if it's going to do you any good, you've got to get on board. You have to trust in Jesus Christ. You have to ask him to forgive you for your sins and rescue you from the judgment, the flood of judgment that we all deserve. If you've never done that, you can do it today. We call you to trust in this trustworthy God. And here's the message for believers this morning. If we've trusted in Jesus already, if we know him, Well, we can know that we are safe in his hands. We can know that. Whatever tomorrow or this week or month may bring, we can be sure of that. We know there will be trouble in this world. We know there will be difficulty in our own lives. We know there will be challenges. And we may not know what we are doing. And so often we don't know what we're doing. We haven't got a clue what's going on. We hardly know how we're supposed to live our lives. But the Lord always knows what he is doing. And if we belong to him, we can be sure nothing ever lands on our desk until it's been across his desk. We have a faithful God. He always knows what he's doing. He keeps his promises. We have someone to rely on. And we can celebrate that this morning. And we can go forward into the rest of our lives with confidence, because we have a God who makes promises and will always keep them. Let's just be quiet for a moment and think about that. Let's reflect on that. Think about where you stand, where you are with God. Have you trusted in Jesus? And if you haven't, could this be the time when you do? I'll ask him to come in and take over your life and give you a new start and a wonderful future, and he will do that. And if you believe in him already, are you trusting in him? He's got you and your future and your family and your concerns and your worries and your job and everything else safe in his hands. And we can rely on him. Let's pray quietly for a moment.